quite interesting, the final slide that I should say, I'm Dale Sutton, I'm a professor of sociology, so I'm going to talk about consumption and particularly the tricky problem of consumer behaviour. But the slide that Tim has just shown, was that around the war period?
Yeah.
If you look at 19th century household advice books on cookery and how to live, you know, look after your home properly, it has exactly the same, well, I don't know what that was, but the same list of recommendations about what it means to eat well. So we're not actually dealing with new issues around what it means to eat. It's just largely represented as having different normative or moral problems connected to them. So I'm not going to say anything at all about the what would make a sustainable diet. I think others can talk about that. What I want to do is start by stepping back from the substantive detail of the debate and reflect on the current popularity of behaviour change as both a policy solution and a way of framing debates to deal with wicked problems like sustainability. And I'm going to do this by being informed by social scientific research, and I'm going to argue that conventional behaviour change approaches fundamentally misdiagnose the critical processes that affect what and the way we consume. And I'm going to say that this misdiagnosis is more than just a missed opportunity. It actually results in the framing of problems and possible outcomes in ways that fail to recognise the issues that we need to take account of. I'm going to use three empirical examples to say that what we really need to be doing is focusing on eating practices when it comes to consumption and how those practices are socially organised. And if we do this by taking full account of the major trends and trajectories of eating, which we currently don't, in policy documents at least, we can then start to consider what a long-term transition to sustainable eating should look like and what steps need to be put in place to get there. So my critique of this dominant framing or understanding of consumption and behaviour change is that this behaviour change is seen as a quick win, basically. It's a nice, neat solution for politicians in particular, because the responsibility is placed on individuals to change their behaviour. And it's rooted in a very historically contingent ideological figure of the sovereign consumer. This is the person who relatively autonomously reflects on their lifestyle in light of their available money and time, and then selects goods and services to match their preferences and values. It's all fun. Framed in this way, attention is focused on influencing consumers to make different choices when they go about their consumption, and their consumption is just shopping. And prominent policy levers are therefore social marketing, information campaigns, and various financial incentives and penalties, which all hope that individuals will conform to some model of rational behaviour, recognising that it would only be sensible to modify their ways of life and save the planet. And yet, even where we find these apparently pro-environmental values, they don't translate into pro-environmental actions. So death row, as far back as 2008, demonstrate that pro-environmental attitudes are consistently higher than the percentage of people who take measures to change their behaviour. And this value action gap, I argue, reveals critical weaknesses in the way that we understand consumption and how we frame this idea of the consumer. And there's much that's been written about this. These are the four sort of key issues that I think we need to take account of. First, it equates consumption with purchase, without any reference to why everyday lives are organised as they are, and therefore why people consume in the ways that they do. Secondly, the extensive evidence of the social patterning of purchases suggests that decisions are not purely personal, but are socially conditioned. Third, choices are never independent from one another. Past choices rule out future options, but also structure the opportunities for different ways of living. And finally, perhaps most fundamentally, many items are acquired repetitiously. Some items that are routinely used up, like groceries or, say, petrol, are rarely subject to individual deliberation. A great many items of ordinary consumption, like electricity and water, are acquired and consumed mindlessly, and probably necessarily so. Much of the most environmentally problematic features of consumption are largely invisible, unremarkable, and unrecorded at the point of purchase or use. So in other words, the evidence does not suggest that individuals make individualised choices, but that consumption is habitual and routine, and above all else, a matter of societal organisation. When we apply this framing to food consumption specifically, we see a significant narrowing of how we understand eating. So the family meal is presented as the default and pervasive model of meal organisation. In fact, in some of the food policy reports, it's shocking how much it's automatically assumed that the principal way that we eat in society is by somebody buying something from the supermarket, taking it home, storing it in a freezer, then cooking it, and then serving it to usually her children and her partner. Secondly, due to the conflation of consumption with purchase, the overwhelming focus of analysis is on food purchasing from retailers. And third, both analysis, debate and policy approaches come to centre around the life cycle assessment of carrots and the nutritional content of peas. This is the logic of production. Food producers make and retailers sell products, but people eat meals. So the outcome of this narrow framing is that whilst there is some recognition of the very many and contradictory anxieties relating to eating habits, there's no systematic analysis of them beyond a conflation around the logic of win-wins. So we're focusing on a healthy, sustainable, safe, friendly, fair, and animal-friendly set of produce. This leads to an over-reliance on information campaigns, such as labelling, a continual lamenting of the inability of consumers to properly eat, which I find slightly surprising given that if you look at the sales of cookery books, who watches what TV programmes, and concern about where to go and eat, celebrity chefs and so on, culinary culture is everywhere. And it's one of the striking features of the way that eating or food consumption has changed in the last 20 years. It leads to a complete failure to recognise that the self-service family meal is not the only model of eating. We eat in a variety of ways, and one of the major trends in food consumption of the last 20 years is eating out. And we end up reducing all of these problems to a matter of changing attitudes, enabling or preventing, and inspiring people to try and consume in a normative way, prescribed by policymakers. And above all, it assumes that consumer behaviour is entirely static. If nothing is done, we will continue to eat exactly the same as we do in 20 or 30 years' time. But actually, food consumption is constantly changing at different rates and in different ways. And it's that we need to focus on. So in terms of trying to think differently, I've got a feeling this slide is the wrong way. I'll have to come back to that one. A number of research projects that we've conducted at the SCI suggest that the most important thing when it comes to thinking about eating, food consumption, is to look at how it's socially organised. And together our project suggests that to shift eating practices in desirable directions requires a focus on how meals are organised and how they're provisioned. They also suggest that eating practices are dynamic and that recognition of these critical trajectories of change in the practice of eating is the starting point for developing systematic policy measures to achieve societal changes. So I'm going to give three quite specific examples to try and illustrate where I'm coming from. And the first focuses on the social organisation of snacking. Now, framed through the sovereign consumer approach, we end up with a story of popular anxieties about contemporary eating in which snacking is it's a symbolic of individualised eating, of grazing, of a fragmented life. We're all too busy, so we end up stuffing our faces with more pre-prepared meals, more takeaways, more snacking, and more grazing. And we do this alone. But our research shows that snacking contrary to this popular assumption, is incredibly socially ordered. Rather than being an activity of time-pressured individuals grabbing a bite to eat while running between meetings, or bored individuals with little discipline other than to graze their way through the day, Alan Ward and Luke Yates' research found that snacking is highly routinised and a sociable activity. And these two graphs show that. So we see peaks in weekday consumption, which is the top one, where many of the snacking, the moments when we eat snacks, occur around 10 or 11 o'clock, around 3 o'clock, and around sort of late as well. Supper time in our language. So the work break still exists, perhaps a leftover from when we used to work in factories and you had no choice but to take your 15-minute break at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. So these cultural conventions still act to structure our day. And what's also interesting about it is that if you see the different colours, 50% of our snacking occasions are done in the company of other people. So it's a highly sociable activity. It's not individualised in the way that it's presented in the literature at all. And we can see that even on the weekends, where people aren't at work, you see a similar pattern. It's just that the morning snack becomes less pronounced. A second example, which draws from the same sorts of data and methodology, looks at the implications of these kinds of trends for the content of our meals. Alan Ward and Luke Yates again set out to compare the results from our survey, which used Tesco's club card data, with that of a similar survey conducted in the 1950s. And the results are quite interesting. In many respects, the main meal of the day, which has shifted from lunchtime to the evening meal, has not fundamentally changed at all. Or not as much as we might have expected. So yes, there is more pasta, and perhaps a greater diversity of the presentation of meals, but fish or meat with some form of carb, usually potato, completely dominates, as it did in the 50s. But it's not the case for breakfast and lunch. Breakfast, which was dominated by eggs and bacon in the 1950s, is now almost entirely cereals and breads, and less people eat it. Lunch, in the 1950s, it was estimated that 6 out of 10 midday meals taken by working men were eaten at home, and now only home workers eat at home. Lunchtimes consisted of stews, roasts, and full meals, and today the sandwich completely dominates. So how can we start to try and explain these changes? Well, one hypothesis would be that this is to do with changing attitudes. Lighter lunchtimes and breakfast meals being the successive nutritional advice in changing our attitudes to food. But a more compelling answer, consistent with all the data on the change in organisation of eating practices, rests in changes in the labour market. More women working, people working further away from home and commuting, more service industry jobs, and the lunch hour disappearing. This is evidence that eating practices change less because of individual attitudes and more because of shifts in the ways that we organise our societies and our everyday lives. And my final example is the freezer and frozen food. And some years ago, myself and Elizabeth Shrove set out to try and explain the phenomenal diffusion rate of the UK's domestic freezer, from 3% of households in 1969 to 97% of households having at least one by the early 1980s. By the end of the 1980s, half of those households had two freezers. So what happened to make the freezer so important to our day-to-day lives? And in a nutshell, we argue that this is also to do with changes to the labour market. Yep, I didn't finish. The rise of out-of-town supermarkets. But the interesting question about supermarkets and out-of-town supermarkets is what came first, the freezer or the supermarket? Because they're mutually dependent upon one another. And the use of the freezer and frozen foods has changed alongside the change in design and use of our kitchens, the technologies within it, and including things like microwaves, and there's an interesting story that could be told about that as well. Now, the important point is that the freezer itself has changed. It's not the same thing. It wasn't appropriated for some utility value. Its meaning changed. At first, it was about novelty foods, about ice cream. By the 70s, it was all about bulk buying, and by now, by the 80s and 90s, it became a device of convenience. And these changes have locked us into patterns of eating in the way that Tim has just described, that are vast, incredibly environmentally problematic, but which make us and shape the way that we eat today and seem to be something that we can't imagine getting ourselves outside of. So my point to try and bring this together is that what and the way we eat is a matter of societal organisation of eating habits. It follows that if we want to change food consumption in any directions, we need to pay attention to this societal organisation. This means a focus on practices of eating and meal occasions above a focus on individual attitudes or a focus on individual products. It means recognising that eating practices are dynamic and not static, so we need to identify and explore the principal trajectories of eating practices rather than default to that normative assumption of the family meal or the self-catered home. And these trends, I think, are largely underplayed. If we take just those two points alone, it means that we need to consider what future eating practices might look like. For example, the kitchen as home, where we eat out predominantly. Or we could think about the end of the supermarket to be replaced by supermarkets as domestic service providers, which might include food. Or we could think about the reinstitutionalisation of the lunchtime. Quite interestingly, some research in France by a guy called Jean-Pierre Poulain argues that the French are not as fat as the British because the French eat lunches, long lunches, subsidised through workplaces, which start with a starter. A starter doesn't tend to have very much meat in it, and people feel satiated after 20 minutes, so they eat less of the main course. They eat a smaller volume of the main course, of which is subsidised by companies. 70% of the meal is non-vegetarian, it's vegetables. Whether he's right, we don't know. But we don't consider these kinds of options. And we need to do this to have visions of future eating practices, a meta-narrative, to open up debates about what sort of food culture we want, as opposed to the current ad hoc, short-termism, campaign-focused styles of policy that we currently have. We need a meta-narrative to set out a direction for reflexive programmes of coordinated policies. And this is the kind of step change that we need in the way that we understand, think about consumption or food consumption, and how we might translate that into policy policy strategies. Thank you.
Thank you.